Welkom bij de CMR Podcast, een podcast van het Centrum voor Migratierecht.
Migration is a phenomenon of all time and always a topical issue. In this podcast we discuss migration in the broad sense. Migration law determines who can access the territory of a country, which rights migrants have, integration as well as equal treatment, citizenship. Migration law is international, European, regional, national, and can sometimes even be local. Researchers of the Dutch Center for Migration Law of the Radboud University in Nijmegen have been examining migration law from an interdisciplinary angle for a good 3 decades. In this podcast, we provide a behind-the-scenes view of our research and the involvement of researchers in policymaking. My name is Karen Geertsema. I'm Assistant Professor of Migration Law, and I'm doing this podcast together with my colleague, Ricky van Oers, who is also Assistant Professor at the Center, with a special focus on migrant inclusion. Let's get started.
So today, joining us in the studio is Jasper Kommendijk. Jasper is a member of the Center for Migration Law. He is a professor of human rights law and director of the Research Center for State and Law. His teaching and research focus on human rights, the rule of law, and effective legal protection. He is particularly interested in the interaction between international human rights and the Dutch legal order. Kommendijk, or as we say, Jasper, combines legal dogmatic research with empirical research to develop a good perspective on the law in practice. Since 2022, he holds the Jean Monnet Chair on the Rule of Law in the National and EU Legal Orders, as part of which he and his students, for example, provide guest lectures on the rule of law in primary schools. It's only 1 week ago that Jasper delivered his inaugural lecture, which had as a title the question, "The Effectiveness of Human Rights in a Multi-Level Legal Order Under Threat." Human rights and the rule of law have been under pressure in recent years. On the one hand, human rights courts and monitoring bodies are increasingly challenged by populist politicians. But on the other hand, there's also criticism from academic circles. Human rights would, for instance, fail to address socioeconomic inequality and have too much top-down motivation. Reason for concern? Yes. Reason for pessimism? No. That is what Jasper argued in his lecture last week. So Jasper, thank you for accepting our invitation and welcome here with us in the studio. So to start, human rights have been criticized for having a top-down motivation, but you claim that this is no reason for pessimism. So can you explain this criticism, and can you also tell us why you think it's no reason for pessimism?
Yes, thank you first of all for having me in this show. I'm a true admirer of this recently started podcast. So what I argued was basically that, there has been a lot of criticism obviously coming from, let's say, politicians, but also courts, but also interestingly from within the human rights circle, so professionals working for NGOs and especially grassroots smaller organizations, and they essentially criticize the very elitist Western biased the top-down phenomenon of international human rights institutions, UN institutions, but also professional NGOs like Amnesty International or Open Society, and criticize their, let's say, very top-down focus, ignoring essentially what happens on the ground. Well, no reason for pessimism. Indeed, during my lecture, I reflected upon this criticism in order to show that there's no need to despair and be too pessimistic. I think what we've seen also is that the acceptance of the concept of human rights as such has been generally better. I think everyone agrees that the underlying concepts, justice, dignity, equality, are still very important, and support for these values is quite high. So it's very much this top-down international focus that has been criticized. Another reason why we shouldn't be too pessimistic, or at least I put that into perspective, has to do with the fact that what is especially known in medicine, so-called information and detection biases, because we simply know more of what is happening in the world in terms of media, but also NGOs being very active and monitor the situation on the ground. Well, they detect abuses, violations, so we might get the impression that things are getting worse and worse.
But we know more.
Because we know more, indeed, yeah. And we see more. So in essence, human rights NGOs become the victim of their own success.
And Jasper, you describe very good the bottom-up mobilization of rights that is needed, the activism from the ground that helps in effectuating these human rights. Could you illustrate this with some examples in the field of migration law?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what I see, if I've studied also in my PhD, what happens after there is, for example, criticism from UN treaty bodies, or what you see after a court judgment, which is negative for the government, especially with non-binding criticism from UN bodies, you see that the reaction of the government is, well, we're not going to change this immediately. And, well, if nothing happens in terms of lobby and follow-up at the national level by domestic actors such as NGOs, then nothing will happen. So it's important that this mobilization starts and that the recommendations are being used by these domestic actors to support their lobby. And what I've seen, well, in my PhD of exactly 10 years ago, I studied, all the recommendations made by the UN treaty bodies in relation to the Netherlands, New Zealand and Finland, and looked at what happened. So my definition of effectiveness is changes in terms of policy, legislation, or even more broader and subtle changes. Well, I just looked at my PhD research again, and for the 74 recommendations that I found to be, let's say, partly or completely effective, 6 related to migration law. And well, I could have a look in I made these fancy tables discussing all the specific aspects. So for the Netherlands, for example, what has happened as a result of criticism of the Committee Against Torture is that medical reports were, well, and this is more than 10 years ago, were integrated in the asylum procedure. And there has also been, it's not only policy and legislative change, but an evaluation of the gender dimension of the asylum policy following comments of the CEDAW committee. And I think one, which is not so much included in my book, but at least for the Netherlands, a well-known saga is the whole BBB. It's not the recent political party, but Bedbad en Brood, that was an issue 10 years ago. So what should we support to undocumented migrants? Could we leave them on the streets? Well, there has been a legally non-binding decision by the European Committee on Social Rights, who said, well, this is a violation of the European Social Charter. Well, the government was reluctant to then provide, bread. It's the BBB.
Bread,
It makes it confusing. So the government reaction initially, even with, let's say, quite a, well, solid, not anti-migration government, was still rather reluctant. So it took national courts and, well, NGOs and people to bring these cases to obtain this change. So several courts, district courts, but eventually also the highest administrative court, relied on this decision and said, this is an authoritative interpretation. So we rely upon that and we actually rule in line with the decision, forcing a change upon the government.
On so this social takes economic rights,
yeah.
Also part of the criticism that there's too little attention for those rights.
Yeah.
You mentioned now the role of national courts in making this happen. And after your PhD, you also conducted empirical data on the role of national judges in preliminary reference procedures at the Court of Justice of the European Union. And if I say it correctly, I think from this research follows that in the Netherlands, migration law judges, both the Council of State and Court of First Instances, are very active in the preliminary reference procedure. Do you see a connection here with this role of national judges with that bottom-up mobilization?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a connection if you compare the Netherlands with, for example, Greece, even though Greece is also confronted by, well, not to say the least, migration challenges. You see hardly any references being made from Greece, or I think there are no reference to the Court of Justice. Whereas in the Netherlands, a wide variety of references are being made. And that also has to do, I think, indeed with mobilization by actors, especially asylum lawyers were quite active, who have also organized themselves in various committees. The Commissie Strategisch Procedure in the Netherlands is an example.
It's the Dutch Refugee Council.
Yeah, has this committee in which academics, lawyers, they actively look for cases in which they provide assistance, in-depth expertise, and also try to, let's say, have a court refer a case to Luxembourg. So there has been this mobilization. And I think also judges, at least at the asylum side, some are also, I don't like to use the term activist, because that is a wrong label, but they're engaged, they're eager, they very much rely on an EU law framework in their work, and that means that if they spot that policy deviates from EU law, they signal that to the Court of Justice and ask, there is a friction, what shall we do? So you also see, I wouldn't say mobilization by judges, but they actively look for references, and that is quite an important mindset for judges to have. And you also see that now more and more at the level of the Council of State, also being pushed perhaps a bit into this direction by very active lower court judges.
So Jasper, you've referred to human rights as a trump card that can be used to defend certain interests. Immigration law, this, for instance, connects to the discussion on the best interests of the child. Migrants referring to their children and their children's rights to obtain residence, family life being used as a trump card. At least that's what some claim. Can you reflect on this and what this discussion means for the effectiveness on human rights?
Yeah, so just going back again to my PhD research, I looked at six different UN human rights treaties, including the CRC, so the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And of the 74 effective recommendations, more than the majority related to the Committee on the Rights of the Child. And why is that? Well, we just discussed the mobilization point. Well, mobilization is generally higher in relation to children's rights because we have very active NGOs, Defense for Children, UNICEF, in all three countries, actually. But it also has to do with the salience of children. I think, you wouldn't find anyone on the street saying, I'm against children's rights. Whereas if you talk about human rights and you talk about, let's say, criminals or these groups of society, they have less automatic support. So everyone is in favor of children. That also means that what you see in terms of lobby and litigation, mobilization, is that NGOs very much use children, perhaps in an instrumental way to obtain change. I think one of the most typical examples here in the Netherlands is the case of Mauro, who started crying in a talk show, and everybody, had sympathy with him, and then that does something. So that makes it easier to rally around and makes it easier for NGOs to lobby. And I think that also has, downsides or negative effects. What I sometimes hear in governmental circles, or even sometimes some judges say that, in the field of migration, it becomes easy for parents to take a kid with them or send a kid to Europe, and that gives them a claim to residence. So that's I think if NGOs do that all too often, that could also create a backlash.
I don't think that those claims have been backed up by actual data that this is actually happening. So I guess that's also something for future research, maybe to prove that this claim of people misusing their child in order to obtain residence is actually an incorrect one.
I agree, but it's an impression. The same, more at a general level, the phenomenon of human rights proliferation, that issues are increasingly framed in terms of human rights. That also, it shows the success of human rights as a label, as a trump card, as a discourse, but it also shows the downside. It could also backlash.
The backlash, yeah.
Yeah, and you refer to that in your inaugural lecture also, that in connection to environmental law and climate change, that it's not always self-evident that there's a connection between climate change and human rights and the human rights framework, so that we should be careful, isn't it?
Yeah, Well, I didn't necessarily mention that. I just observed that, like many others have done, that there is a rights turn in relation to climate change. So the whole issue of climate change was not necessarily seen as a human rights issue until 10 years ago with the Urgenda judgment from the Dutch Supreme Court. Well, increasingly it has been seen as that. The Klimaseniorinien judgment of the Strasbourg Court of the beginning of April also shows that. Well, I don't think it's necessarily bad or good. I think for climate, it's a good development. I mentioned another example in my lecture in the field of taxation, whereby normal financial interests are framed in terms of human rights. And there's even one case in which an applicant before the Dutch Supreme Court framed the issue of certain allowances that were lowered in terms of slavery. Yeah, well, if you push it to these limits, this might lead to, let's say,
A backlash.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that the judge didn't go along with this.
No, so the judge didn't go along with it, but you only need some people to pick that up,
right,
and ridicule that. So I also give
so
the example.
So keep this podcast a secret.
Well, yeah.
So the Netherlands, turning to reality again, the daily affairs, will, if all goes according to plan, have a new government as of next week. And among the coalition parties is the extreme right PVV, the Freedom Party of Geert Wilders. And in your inaugural lecture, you stated that judgments from the European Court of Human Rights of Strasbourg are closely weighed and examined by the government generally, up until now at least. But you also reflected upon, during this podcast, about the case of the Klimaseniorinnen. And we recently saw that the Swiss Parliament has announced to ignore this verdict. And what do you think that this could imply? Do you think that such situations could be occurring in the Netherlands as well under the upcoming right-wing, extreme right-wing government? Seeing the plan so far, for instance, in the field of migration and court cases that this will probably bring about.
Yeah, it's not something new. Also in the Netherlands, we have seen criticism of political parties and politicians, even Mark Rutte. They criticized also judgments from Strasbourg, especially in the field of migration. Recently, a BBB politician also criticized the Klimaseniorinnen. And then you get this usual and rather cheap criticism in that the judge is sitting on the chair of
the lawmaker.
Yeah, the lawmaker. Whereas I think, especially if you look at the Klimaseniorinnen judgment, and I would everyone advise to do so, the court addresses meticulously in three pages why there is a need for courts in a rule of law constitutional system to also provide checks and balances. So we've seen this criticism in relation to migration law also before, also politicians arguing that we should leave the Refugee Convention. But I expect this to happen more and more because, various plans of the government, they actually contradict EU law and international norms, especially in the area of human rights law, especially in migration law. So courts are then put in a position of bogeyman. They have to say what politicians know, namely that policy and legislation are violating these norms. And the government wants to renegotiate certain EU laws. But, that's also the point of my lecture, is that the multi-level human rights order consists of various sources and documents. So you can renegotiate laws. But what about the EU Charter and all these other values at the EU level, let alone the ECHR, let alone UN treaties? So leaving aside whether it's legally feasible, you force the court in a very difficult position, leading to criticism of politicians. And that, in the long run, undermines, let's say, the legitimacy of courts and support from the population for courts. So I'm worried about that. So what we'll see is most probably many court cases coming up, and we know what is going to happen, and that is really damaging if that happens intentionally.
But at least if we know, we can prepare in some way, develop a strategy maybe
Well, and that's in your lecture, you also come up with an approach, at least for academics, but maybe also to prepare our students as future lawyers that have to solve all these problems. I really liked how you showed the complexity of the multi-level human rights order, and you used an example from of migration law to illustrate this, namely the pushbacks of migrants traveling from Turkey to Greece on the sea. It's a perfect illustration of how different actors and different legal frameworks and procedural routes or international fora apply to make human rights effective for this matter. And I think I personally, as a teacher of migration law, but I'm sure you agree, see how students have difficulties in grasping the complexity of a multi-level legal order in migration law, but I think more general. And it always makes me wonder if our educational approach is fit for this purpose. How can we offer our students a solid legal doctrinal picture of these different legal systems and prepare them to become actors in making human rights effective in the future?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it starts first perhaps with, let's say, all the options, at least how I see it, the multi-level human rights order. It's rather procedural. You have to know as a student or a future legal practitioner, well, if you want to address something, to which court or body you could go. So this is very much procedural law, and I think most students are not necessarily very happy with discussing procedural law, but perhaps we bring that to them in a very boring fashion. If we make it more attractive by putting a certain case at the heart and throw that to students, what about the phenomenon of pushbacks? How could you address that? What options do you have? Look at EU law, look at the ECHR and challenge them to really see how can you bring this case to a particular court and what do you need? What do you need to show? I think that could make it more interesting for them.
And then because you both call for a doctrinal approach, to have a strong a legal doctrinal picture, but you also emphasize the need for empirical research. Mm-hmm. Is that also something we should integrate in our education?
I think we should do so, but I think I would make sure that, people studying law, so our students, they have a very solid legal doctrinal basis, so what we call an Allen civil effect. So I wouldn't do away with that. So I wouldn't opt for these, I'm a huge fan of university colleges. I also taught at university colleges. I did a bachelor in international relations. So I'm very happy with that broad basis. But I also deliberately chose to do a law degree and also a law degree which led me to civil effect, exactly because you need a solid doctrinal basis. So I would push students, and I know that in these difficult times in which there's already a lot of stress, I would push them to do these other courses on politics, political science, international relations, empirical stuff, to do that aside or in addition to the legal doctrinal basis, not instead, or to come up with a very broad program. Because in order to, and that's the main point in my lecture, to do good empirical research, qualitative research, you really need a good understanding of what the law entails and what, for example, if you are going to study what happens after court judgments in relation to this particular area, you need to be able to understand what the court judgment demands and you need to know the intricacies. So many, let's say, especially quantitative scholars have done this, but what are they then studying and what kind of claims do they make? In order to really understand what is going on, you need to understand the law and what it requires, and you need to be able to put that in the wider legal context. So we need very good lawyers who are able to also do a bit more.
In order to prevent accidents from happening, doing qualitative empirical research without understanding the actual
and then come up
basis
with,
where you're operating.
With far-ranging claims saying human rights institutions have been ineffective, or we see a great improvement in terms of human rights, without really being able to know whether there's any, let's say, causal relation between, well, particular judgments and the change. So you really need to understand all these dynamics on the ground.
Do not underestimate the complexity of law and the legal profession.
Yeah, sometimes if you talk with academics from other disciplines, they think law is straightforward, it's easy. You can find the law in textbooks and in statutes, but... Well, you really have to tell them, well, we're an academic discipline. It's all about interpretation and very much context dependent. So it's not easy. And that also makes it very nice, at least in my view.
Hear, hear.
Thank you very much, Jasper. I think that's a good call. We need good lawyers who do a bit more. Thank you all for listening to our third podcast on migration law. We don't have a next speaker planned yet, but stay tuned for our next podcast.